Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Wildlife is under siege around the globe. The combination of human encroachment on traditional wildlife habitats and climate change are leading to stresses that threaten the very survival of some species. Of course, this isn't the first time in Earth's history that plants and animals have had to adapt to change, and that includes our part of the world, North Carolina. Fossil evidence shows just how the landscape has morphed over time and the impact that had on plant and animal life. Perhaps a look back at what happened in previous times can help us help the plants and animals being threatened today, and that's what we'll do this hour. Manly Fuller is Vice President of Conservation Policy at the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. Welcome back. Good to see you again.
See you.
He joins us along with Dr. Christian Kammerer, Research Curator at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. And Aviva Rossi. Dr. Aviva Rossi is wildlife ecology professor at the University of San Francisco and research director of the Gulch Environmental Foundation, which is working to address climate change through various initiatives, education, and championing the principles of regenerative agriculture. Thank you for being here as well, and thank you for getting up early. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So because it's so early and you're so wide awake, I'm going to start with you, Dr. Rossi. There have been five mass extinctions in Earth's history, and scientists say we shouldn't be worrying about the sixth mass extinction being in our future because it's happening now, and it's entirely our fault. And one scientist says that 173 species went extinct between 2001 and 2014, more than you would expect. Under normal circumstances, more than 4,000 vertebrate species went extinct in the past 100 years. Normally, if you agree with all those numbers, something that large would have taken about 10,000 years. So what are the implications of that on animal life and on humans?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'm glad to hear you loop in the end humans part of it, because in these discussions, we often forget that we are an integral part of this system. So in addition to our ability to influence, we also very heavily depend on it. So when we're talking about these mass extinction events, and I'm sure that Dr. Kammerer can address this more from, you know, the deep time perspective, you know, when we talk about this has happened five times in the past, this has happened only five times across a span of billions of years. And so when we're talking about what a big deal this is a catastrophic loss of species. And it's not, you know, there are different types of vulnerability. So there, you know, as we change the world and we're losing species, not just individual species, but entire groups of organisms. And when we talk about ecosystems, one of the things that we look at is the function of that ecosystem, how stable it is, how much it can adapt to change over time. And one of the ways that it can adapt to changes is by all of the diversity that exists in that system, all of the different species, all of the different subspecies. And so when we start to lose some of that diversity, we start to lose some of the adaptive capacity of not just an individual species, but of these entire functioning systems that all of the species within them depend on, as well as us. And so it's that's one of the consequences. It's not just the loss of the species themselves, which if we lose a species to extinction, that's forever. We can never get it back. But when we lose so many species across all of these functioning systems, we're losing the role that they played, whether it's cleaning the water or dispersing seeds. We're losing these functions across all of these different systems globally that we all depend on as for the species themselves and as living beings in this system. Mm.
Manly Fuller is here. He's the Vice President of Conservation Policy with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. Scientists say, Manly, that plants and animals are disappearing 1,000 times faster than they have in the past 65 million years. Try to put that in your brain. They say 100 species are becoming extinct every day, and that will continue throughout this century. I'm just curious if you know how many of those species are native to North Carolina, animal and plant, and how many of them have disappeared in that same period or are on the brink of disappearing today in this state?
Well, another way of saying that is we have about 460 species that are considered of conservation need in North Carolina, and some of those are particularly sensitive to climatic change. For instance, if you look at the higher elevation species of plants and animals, they can't keep up going up the mountain because they're near the tops of the mountains. And then on the coast, things like shorebirds and sea turtles and low-lying forests are particularly sensitive. So those are some examples of areas and types of habitats that are particularly vulnerable to climate change.
And in terms of population growth, North Carolina is among the fastest growing states in the country. And we know in Charlotte, if you live in Charlotte, you know, if you've lived here for any amount of time, you know about the disappearing tree canopy, you know about subdivisions being cut into what used to be farmland or natural animal habitats. What impact is growth and development having on this disappearance of species here?
Growth in the Piedmont is there's a tremendous loss of native habitats, and as you said, loss of tree cover, and we need to be planting more native trees. That's the Piedmont, and then certain areas of the coast and the mountains are very high growth rates also. So that you have climatic change, and then you have growth related changes to habitats, which can have a cumulative impact.
Dr. Christian Kammerer is here with the North Carolina Museum of Natural Science. You study the fossil record here and all over the world. When species go extinct, something that Aviva Rossi talked about a moment ago, that must have reverberations throughout the ecosphere. So when you look at the fossil record, what can you tell about what happened when species disappeared in the past and the impact of that on that ecosystem? And what can you tell about what's happening today? Can you measure it today, the impact?
Yes, absolutely. One thing to note is that, you know, species do go extinct all the time in what is called background extinction. So this is the usually quite low rates of species loss that are considered normal throughout history, that, you know, 10,000% figure that you cited is much higher than the normal rates of background extinction. It's getting into mass extinction levels. And what we see during mass extinctions is a fundamental destabilization, not only of individual species and individual communities, but of ecosystems writ large. So in particular, in the mass extinctions that I study, sort of between the Permian and the Triassic, and Triassic and Jurassic periods, early in the age of dinosaurs, we see that there's a breaking point following a certain amount of loss of primary producers and consumers, so plants and herbivores, that leads basically to a snowball effect where the entire ecosystem collapses and all of the other parts of that kind of energy pyramid, the predators that feed on herbivores and so on, end up going extinct at more or less the same time. So there are definite potential for major reverberations once you lose enough of those kind of like ground levels of an ecosystem.
We're all kind of dependent on the system working in the background, it seems to me. I'm not sure whether this question goes to you, Dr. Kammerer, or you, Dr. Rossi, but can you compare this to the supply chain disruption that we experienced post-COVID or even during COVID, when suddenly paper towels and toilet paper and other things that we came to rely on were simply not available? So as things disappear in the ecosystem, that happens to animals, it happens to humans. Is that correct?
I'll take a little bit at first and then I'll hand it back. So one of the main differences to that I'd like to just start with is that when we lose a species to extinction, it's gone forever. Mm. When we lost this process in the supply chain, that could recover, right? Like it could recover very quickly. When we're talking about recovering the function of many species that were in a system that were lost through the process of evolution, that is recovery time of tens of millions of years until we get that function back. So I think to some extent, yes, you know, a disruption in the system may possibly, but the recovery from it, I think, is fundamentally different because we still had all of those systems in place once we could, you know, get the rhythm back. But it's a little different when we're talking about extinction.
Well, so. Christian, the last mass extinction involved the disappearance of one of your specialty areas, the disappearance of the dinosaurs. It was a long time ago. It was 66 million years ago. That mass extinction and the previous four mass extinctions involved wiping out about 70 to 95% of the species of plants and animals and microorganisms that were part of the ecology of the Earth back then, as I'm told. Clearly, this did not happen overnight, and the Earth adapted. It's a different Earth than it was 66 million years ago. And if we have another mass extinction, the same thing will happen, I would think, over time. What would happen if we lost 70 to 95% of the current species on Earth? What would happen?
Well, I think we'd see something quite similar to what happened in the previous mass extinctions.
Are we the dinosaurs?
No, I mean, humans are not going to come out on top in this situation. So any large vertebrates we've seen in basically all previous mass extinctions are, there's an outsized chance for large-bodied animals and particularly sort of complex life like ourselves to be going extinct in these mass extinction events. It's related to sort of energy requirements of that time. So, you know, the less there is for large animals, because we need lots and lots of food, energy to survive, the less of a chance there is for our ongoing survival. So probably the most likely survivors are going to be sort of small generalists, things like various insects among vertebrates, things like rodents and maybe some lizards we're looking at, that in time, you know, would evolve into sort of new dynasties of organisms. But as Dr. Rossi said, this is happening at million year, tens of million year timescales. It's not something that we can think, well, okay, in 10 million years, it'll be fine. None of us will be alive. The human species will not exist to see that. We need to care about what's happening sort of during the extinction event, because that's what's sort of really pursuant to our lives.
But that does bring me to this question. Obviously, the dinosaurs were not aware of what was happening to them. They were just dying out. Obviously, our survival, human survival, is of utmost importance to us, and probably only to us. It's probably not that important to the Earth. So I ask, because if we're the cause, we must be the solution, all right, Dr. Rossi? I mean, there is no ecological system looking out for us, so we have to be the solution.
Yeah, so I will say when we're talking about the previous extinction events, as you mentioned, you know, this is the first one that really is driven by a single species. But also I wanted to add on a little bit to some of the conversations about timescales, you know, whether or not humans are going to be around, you know, as on this millions of year timescale. Like our current civilizations have only been around really since in this period of climate stability around, you know, I think around 9,000 years ago was when we developed modern agriculture. And Dr. Kammer could, again, check me on how long humans have been around, but I think 200,000 or 300,000 years. And so when we're talking about millions of years for recovery, that's beyond the scale of humans.
We have to take a break. There's so much more to talk about. We're going to talk about climate change, the impact of that, and also the impact of urbanization and the loss of forest areas as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about threats to and adaptation of plants and wildlife in a changing world, that much of the change is coming from human activity and interference. We're talking about it with Manly Fuller, who's Vice President of Conservation Policy with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, Dr. Christian Kammerer, Research Curator at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Science, and Dr. Aviva Rossi, Wildlife Ecology Professor and Research Director of the Gulch Environmental Foundation. She's also with the University of San Francisco. Manly, there are plant and animal species in North Carolina that I know you're watching closely now. Which ones are you most concerned about disappearing or being endangered by these challenges that we're talking about?
Well, if you look at species like one that has a lot of public interest, the native brook trout in the mountains, that occurs in cold water streams, higher elevations. That's sensitive to warmer temperatures. You know, we could lose that. If you look at their historical ranges, you can see that there's a potential constriction taking place of that. Animals that, shorebirds or sea turtles, the sea level rises can significantly impact them. And we have new species come popping up in North Carolina that we're not sure what the effects of that. Recently, a land crab showed up in near Morehead City, which is typically found down in the Caribbean. sharks some shark species have moved further north than they historically occurred. There's a lot of changes taking place. We've got invasive big lizards like the black and white tegu. They're now in South Carolina and Georgia. They're originally from South America, and they're spreading further north. So there, you have to look at all these impacts of.
Let me ask you this, because nothing stays the same. Everything changes over time. And you're watching changes right now, some of which we're causing, some of which I suppose could happen under natural and normal circumstances. But how do you know when to be concerned? Because nothing stays the same. Things are always changing. How do you know when a red flag has gone up?
What we've been talking about on the show earlier, the rate of change, the rapid change, rapidly increasing, intense hot spells or changing in rainfall patterns or sea level rising. And that has profound impacts both on the natural world and also the built environment of humans.
So, Dr. Kammerer, your colleague David Button at the North Carolina State and at NC State and the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, after examining fossil records that previous mass extinctions resulted in the survival of a low number of species and that spread their sameness across the world. In other words, as things went extinct, new things didn't pop up to take their place, and so we became less diverse over time. There was biodiversity loss, and the same thing is likely to occur in the future if we keep going down this track. Why does that matter, that we have less diversity?
So, I mean, there are a few points there. One is, I think, kind of just like the inherent dignity of organisms. You know, there is on kind of even an emotional level, wanting to continue to be able to see things like zebras or giraffes or elephants and know that they're part of our world, even if giraffes aren't, you know, hugely important for the economy. But there also are kind of real negative repercussions, even to sort of our human lives through a lot of the biodiversity loss that we might not even be aware of until it's too late. So thinking about things like novel discoveries in biochemicals and biopharmaceuticals from marine animals and, you know, things in tropical rainforests, for instance, potential threats to our food supply. There's been a lot of discussion lately with climate changes potentially causing crop failures or pandemics of plants causing crop failures. So we're looking for alternate food sources and also greater genetic diversity in the crops that we have in order to protect them against diseases. Like, a lot of our crops are monocultures, so we're not getting sort of the full range of stability that we might have in kind of a natural population. So I think there's merit to saving species both on their own, like on its own basis, but also sort of thinking about our own survival and like what it means for us to kind of be putting all our eggs in one basket for a few species.
I'm sure that there are conservatives who are very concerned about the ecology and the environment and the disappearance of species and where we are on the timeline with sea level rise, etc. But this is another one of those issues in American culture, at least, that seems to be have a left-right divide. There are those who would say, okay, what difference does it make if we lose some animal species or some fern in a forest somewhere goes extinct? Why do I care? And this reminds me of when the late right-wing talk show host Rush Limbaugh would rail against the snail darter, which was a freshwater fish that was holding up the construction of a dam because it was on the verge of extinction. So, Dr. Rossi, explain why Mr. Limbaugh was short-sighted in his defense of human endeavors over the survival of a seemingly inconsequential species. Why does it matter if it's holding up the economy?
So you actually bring up a good question about the difference between when we're looking at things from a conservation issue, from a science perspective, versus the debate that gets in often to the public sphere. And one of the differences is that we often talk about flagship species. These are species that we use as an example, either because they're charismatic or people know them or they exemplify one of the things that we're talking about. But when we're talking about losing species, especially in a mass extinction like we're talking about happening now, we're using these one-off species stories as examples. They're just examples of a greater loss that's happening to all of us. And when we have those individual stories, it's more relatable, but those stories themselves don't necessarily capture the magnitude of the issue. So, and that's, I believe it's I'm trying to remember the name of the logical fallacy, right? When you hold up one example that you can prove wrong easily versus getting into the heart of the bigger issue. And I think that happens a lot in politics on both sides when we're trying to disparage the idea that we don't like. But in this case, all of these individual stories, including the charismatic megafauna stories that we use to drive a lot of conservation, those are just examples. Those are relatable examples that we're using to tell the story of a bigger picture that's so hard to tell with statistics to the general public.
If you lose an animal who's at the top of the food chain, I don't know that tigers or lions are at the top of the food chain, but I do know that they are endangered. What happens to the ecology when they go? If you're at the bottom of the chain, that's something that you starve the top of the chain. But if you're at the top of the chain, what happens when you go?
So, even when we're talking about the top and the bottom of the chain, this is such a great example of why redundancy in ecosystems is so important, why it's so important to have many species that have these roles, so that if we lose one for some reason or another, there's another species, within that system that can kind of take that place. One of the I think the concepts that you might be getting at, we call a trophic cascade. So the trophic levels are the different levels that energy moves through the system. Like Dr. Kammerer referenced earlier, there's the producers, like the plants, the primary consumers that eat the plants, and the things that eat the plants. And when we're talking about losing these top predators, there can be control from top down also. And we saw this there's a wonderful story about the wolves in Yellowstone that really exemplifies this. And wolves were extirpated from Yellowstone for a long time. And we saw the elk really move into a lot of the riparian areas. And through historical recreation with photos, we could see that they had a very heavy impact on the vegetation in these riparian areas. When they reintroduced wolves into Yellowstone, they were reintroducing a top predator that had been extirpated for a long time. So they could study actually really what happened when that predator was brought back in. And what they saw is even before the wolves had gotten to a population where they were controlling the population of the elk, their presence changed the behavior of the elk enough that they were avoiding these heavily covered riparian areas, and it allowed the riparian forest to recover, which allowed the streams to recover, which allowed the bird populations to recover, which allowed the aquatic ecology to recover. So even that, with this great example of this one top predator being reintroduced into a system, we can see how influential they are in regulating those consumers of the plants to help that whole system become more stable.
Everything, as we learned, I think, in high school biology 101 or whatever it was, everything is interconnected. But Dr. Kammer, animals and plants have always had trouble surviving. They come and they go, and scientists say that over two-thirds of the animals and plants that once lived on the Earth are now extinct. So is the problem here what we're witnessing right now, the cycle of death and rebirth, on steroids? Is that the problem here? It's going so fast now that reparatory, if that's the word, processes cannot take hold. We can't fix it. It's going too fast.
Yeah, it's fundamentally a rate issue. So, you know, background extinction, as I mentioned earlier, is kind of a constant. Like, so long as there is life, there will be death. But generally, we see this proceeding over protracted time scales and relatively low species loss at any given time. So you're not losing basically whole assemblages, whole trophic networks. And I think part of the issue that we're looking at today as well is there's a concept in conservation ecology, shifting baselines, that what we're familiar with at the moment is not necessarily even a healthy or stable system. If you look back as recently as 100 years, which again in geological timescales is at the blink of an eye, you know, we're looking at billions of years in my field. The amount of biomass held in, you know, non-human vertebrates exponentially higher, the number of large predators seen in ecosystems exponentially higher than it is today. So basically the change is already happening very rapidly, such that it's in the course of our lifetimes, habitats and the composition of ecosystems has fundamentally changed, and this seems to be going faster and faster.
And in previous extinctions, Manly, no one species was responsible for what was going on. The dinosaurs were not responsible for their demise, but we are. Human encroachment on animal habitat, climate change, which we are playing a major role in, we think, in happening, are all working against flora and fauna and this thing that we've been talking about, the disappearance of species. Are there other factors at play?
Well, one thing that's taken place is there, you know, around the world, there are efforts to restore native habitats. An example in the Southeast is work to restore the longleaf pine ecosystem, which was only a small fraction of its historic extent. There are a number of efforts underway to bring back species that were native to different habitats and try and bring them back. And climate change is a complicating factor in that. There are efforts out in the Midwest to do prairie restoration. There are lots of examples like that where people can work to try and maintain and improve loss of diversity.
So which is worse on what we're talking about? Is climate change the big boogeyman here, or is it the deforestation and human encroachment, or are they somehow on equal footing?
Well, I think they're all taking place, and they're resulting in dramatic shifts in our, like we've talked about, loss of species, and we've talked about simplification of systems, and the diversity adds a level of inherent strength to nature. We've got it's so. Both direct human destruction of habitat or modification of habitat and climate change are all having effects on our natural world.
Dr. Rossi, where are we seeing the worst examples of both, climate change and human encroachment?
Well, I'd like to add on to what Manly was saying with, you know, there's when we can stop habitat loss, or we can do restoration projects, but that's happening within the framework of everything that's happening outside of that plot of land. And there's a couple of things that are impacting species, one of which is climate change, which we're focusing on a lot today. But the second biggest threat to species after direct habitat loss is invasive species, and like you brought up earlier. And so when we're talking about, you know, the impacts or how bad something is, or how bad an extinction crisis might be, it's not just what we've observed now, but what we can forecast based on what we see in the environment. So when we're talking about what might happen with climate change, it's not just what's already happened, it's what we know is going to happen in the next 30 or 50 years. And that's the same actually with the invasive species, because often once they're here and established, they're very difficult to fully eradicate. So the impacts that they're having are going to continue to get worse over time. And so when we're talking about, you know, what might be the worst offenders or the worst eradicators, some of the things that come to mind is when an invasive species moves into a system, you know, these are species that haven't evolved together with the other species in that ecosystem at all, maybe coming from another continent. And this, Dr. Kammerer can talk more to this, but it's, you know, they have been separated on evolutionary timescales for so long that often if a species becomes invasive in a new system, it can take over. And so we get that simplification of the system, the full replacement, and we lose all the functions of those other species. And this is happening at the same time that the habitat loss is reducing the number of areas for natural species. It's happening at the same time that climate change is making the existing habitats more challenging for the native species to live in, and there might not be room for them to adjust spatially to change their range because of habitat loss. And so it's these interactive effects of both the reduced areas where species can live, the encroachment of invasive species that replace natives and kind of, excuse me, simplify that system. And over all of this is this global change where the climate dictates overall, overarchingly, where species can occur. Like, we know that there are deserts in desert areas, and we can envision what they look like because the climate there dictates what species can occur. We know that a tropical forest, what it looks like, because that climate dictates where that can occur. When that changes, everything changes.
So when we come back, we'll talk about climate change, and we will also talk about the impact of human encroachment on previously natural areas that were the province of animals and plant life, which are being squeezed out. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Manly Fuller is with us, Vice President of Conservation Policy with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. Dr. Aviva Rossi, Wildlife Ecology Professor at the University of San Francisco and Research Director of the Gulch Environmental Foundation. And Dr. Christian Kammerer, Research Curator of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Science. He studies the fossil record here and around the world. And let me talk about that with you, Dr. Kammerer, the effects of climate change, because the Earth has been through climate change in the past. We know that. Humans had nothing to do with those periods, but we are told that we are responsible for what we are experiencing today. There's 40% more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than there was in 1700. It's a long time ago, but nonetheless, that's a lot of carbon dioxide over that period of time. Our temperature in this state has warmed by about 1.5 degrees over the last century. Last year was the warmest year on record around the world. How has the area in which North Carolina is now sitting changed over the millennia in terms of its interaction with the climate?
Sure. So I think maybe the most germane comparison is with what's happening earlier in the age of mammals, like when we basically have the modern continents in their current configuration. And what we see in the rock record is that for much of the last 60 million years or so, basically the eastern half of North Carolina was underwater. So when I'm collecting fossils, basically from Rocky Mount East, what we find are seashells, whale skeletons, shark's teeth, in areas that are currently very far inland. So all of this coastal plain has been submerged in the past, during times when there were minimal or no polar ice caps, and most of the water in the poles were then in the oceans. So if the ice caps melt, it is bad news for those of us living east of Raleigh, basically. And, you know, already we're seeing on kind of year by year timescales increasing sort of beach erosion and higher stand tides on the Outer Banks in areas such as this. So, I mean, this is something that at this point is can certainly be mitigated, but is difficult to, you know, fully turn back the clock.
So Manly, we are told that sea levels are rising about an inch a year, or an inch per decade, excuse me. And that doesn't sound like a lot. And most people go, an inch? You won't even be able to measure it. But that's not true, because it's not just the rise of sea level at the beach. It's the encroachment of salt water into the estuaries and up into the rivers, and that changes the ecology of all of that. What is happening in North Carolina today, in addition to that, because of climate change?
In the low-lying portions of the outer coastal plain, you're seeing, if you look at coastal forests, you're seeing die-offs of, say, native pine forests that are not adapted to, they can't tolerate salinity. Atlantic white cedar, that's been documented up in New Jersey. On the west coast of Florida, you can see where cabbage palms are dead. If you fly over the coast down along the peninsula of Florida, you'll see millions of dead cabbage palms where sea level rise is. They can tolerate a little salinity, but they can't tolerate the level of salinity that they're experiencing now.
And what will this mean to humans over time then? And in the short term and the long term?
Well, in the built environment, you've got all sorts of issues, and that's almost another show. But a loss of real estate, and then what do you do about it? Do you rebuild? Do you buy it out, turn it into a green area? That's probably what you should do. But there are all sorts of effects to the built environment, and then to the natural environment. You have, for instance, sea turtles or shorebirds need beach habitat, and as the sea level rises. If you have if you have continuous natural habitat, you may have the beaches can migrate. But then when they run into the built environment and streets and cities and things like that, they can't do it. So animals like shorebirds and sea turtles get squeezed out in that situation.
As the climate warms, there will be these mass migrations. We don't have a sociologist on the program, so we'll not be talking about the human migrations that will inevitably occur from this or the political consequences on that. But when animals and plant species are impacted by climate change, the world around us begins to change. Plants, for the most part, cannot move. They are stuck where they are. I suppose seeds can be blown in the breeze to places where they previously could not germinate, but now because of climate change might be able to, but for the most part, they're stuck where they are. So which is the more troubling aspect of this in terms of species and the survival of species? The fact that alligators that are now in the Everglades may eventually end up in Central Park, or the fact that a fern or a tree cannot move and therefore will die and be gone forever? Or that invasive species will be able to move into areas that for which there is no defense. I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question of.
One thing that's really, really interesting is if you look at mangroves, and mangroves are marching up the coast. They used to be in just Southeast Florida. Now they're North Florida, South Georgia. They may be in South Carolina before too long. I mean, so that's an example of movement. And you see you see lots of other examples of that, where black-tipped sharks are now up common up in Chesapeake Bay. You used to never see them north of Cape Hatteras.
Dr. Rossi, when you hear politicians advocate for drilling more oil and bringing more fossil fuels online that we know warm the planet, have already warmed the planet, and will continue to warm the planet, and you know what that's doing to the ecology of the planet, what goes through your mind?
I will happily answer that in a second. I would like to add on really quick to Manly's topic. So you brought up a great issue when you're talking about movement. And this is one of the things with the pace of change. And we're talking about how quickly the climate's changing. So animals need the habitat that they're living in, which is often dependent on the plants that are there. And when natural climate changes happened in the past, it happened at a pace where plants did move, you know, through seed dispersal, and their ranges shifted because it was at a pace, it was so slow that a forest could regrow along with the pace of climate change. And that is not happening with how fast things are changing now. Okay, so to get back to the oil question, it is very disheartening, because one of the things that, you know, when we talk about the risk, is we talk about the forecasts, what we know is going to happen in the future. And already the amount of carbon, the extra carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere, we're not going to catch up to how much that has heated the world for about 30 years atmospherically, because it takes a while for the oceans to heat up and everything else. So we're already experiencing the changed climate. We're already experiencing these extreme weather events. And we know that we've already got, with what we've already put in the atmosphere, if we stop today, 30 more years of change. So when we're talking about continuing to add to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we are continuing to make the situation worse. With climate change, it's not that we just hit a point and we flip the switch and it changed and all these bad things happen. It is definitely a continuum. And the less change that we can affect, the less damage to the ecosystems, to our economy, to the quality of our lives that's going to happen. And so we're already looking at a future where we're going to be grappling with a lot of the changes that are already in store for us in the next 30 years, unless we start drawing out some of this carbon dioxide. So putting more out there is making everything that we're discussing now that much worse.
So in addition to climate change, we also have to be concerned about human encroachment, which we've alluded to, as we have spread, human beings have spread into previously undeveloped, untouched natural areas. We take down the trees, we alter the landscape to start farms, to drill for oil or mine the land for various minerals. We build cities and suburbs in areas that used to be wild. Manly, what happens to most of those animals who have lived in those areas, who are now living next to a skyscraper or a suburban house?
Well, they either get displaced, or if they're generalists, like things like coyotes or deer, they can persist in close proximity to humans. So depends on whether the species are generalist or they're adapted to a very specific environment. The ones that are adapted to very specific environments, if those environments are eliminated, those species are probably going to be eliminated also. And then we've touched on exotics. And if you go out of the studio and you go down to the first creek in Charlotte, you're gonna find very quickly areas that were historically would have been bottomland type habitats and would have had native cane and things like that. And in many cases, there'll be a jungle of kudzu and privet and multiflora rose, and you almost can't even walk through it. So those are habitats that have changed maybe the hills have been, houses have been built, and then the creeks have been converted into jungles of exotic vegetation. So there's a lot of different impacts that occur when you get human development.
So, Dr. Camber, I'm sure that habitat loss has happened in prehistoric times, or in times where humans had no involvement, either through fires or lava flows or flooding or whatever. Those natural habitats have been destroyed. Perhaps they've come back. But now that humans are doing things that are really permanent, at least permanent in our lifetimes, are we just making things impossible for nature to catch up or to keep pace with?
Well, I guess I want to caution on use of the term impossible, because I think with, climate change discussions get very doom and gloomy. And certainly I have a lot of pessimism about certain aspects of current conservation. But I think, one of the takeaways we should have from conversations such as this is that there's still time to affect meaningful change. So in talking about impossibility, yes, there are certain baked in aspects to climate change that Dr. Rossi brought up earlier in terms of the timescales associated with existing carbon in the atmosphere. But there is, also going back to something we talked about earlier, habitat restoration and shifting both resource usage and sort of energy usage are things that can make sort of those impossibilities a little less impossible.
As we go into places like the rainforest in the Amazon, or even here in North Carolina, as development takes place because more people are flooding in and we have to have places for them to live, work, eat, shop, etc., we are losing these natural areas that were heretofore animal habitats. Are we doing anything on the other side of that equation to increase animal habitats elsewhere as we take them away in one place? Manley, did you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, North Carolina has the legislature supports trust funds like the Land and Water Fund, and that enables us to purchase key areas that have value for parks, game lands, et cetera.
Is it enough to make a difference?
Programs like that are helpful.
Is it enough to make a difference?
We need to do more of it.
Okay. One concern, aside from loss of habitat with this encroachment of humans into animal natural areas, is the damage being done to animals and the damage being done to humans. Because as we come into contact with animals, diseases that we've never been exposed to on both sides are spreading from animals to humans, humans to animals, witness COVID. How big a problem has that become, Dr. Rossi, in recent years, and how big a problem is it likely to come if this continues apace?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's there's a whole field of study that looks at human-wildlife conflict, so that's not necessarily looking at disease transfer, which we've known about for a long time. And this has, any time that you've got, there are these diseases that move between species. And so whether or not it's just humans, this is something that does happen. And the more that we're interacting with wild food sources, that is always a possibility. But when we're talking about encroaching into wildlife habitat, we get into that human-wildlife conflict. So you see this come up like when people want to move into wilderness areas because it's beautiful, but then they're very angry because there's bears that get into the trash and there's coyotes. And so it's one of those that when we consider what is a conflict, it's often we need to change how we're looking at the world. And we can often manage these by changing the way that we're behaving in those environments, removing the food sources. We are in control of starting the conflict, but we can also be in control of how we resolve it.
Let's talk about that because I have about 1 minute left. What can ordinary mortals do? What average humans, not scientists, not politicians, not policymakers, do to make any difference whatsoever? Who would like to take that? Dr. Rossi, go ahead.
I would say the biggest thing you can do is support conservation policy and climate policy.
Anybody else want to chime in on that? We are witnessing adaptations in the ecology, and as human encroachment and climate change has occurred, we're watching it happen before our very eyes. Should we be encouraged by this? And I have about 15 seconds, Dr. Cameron. Should we be, because you've studied the fossil record, should we be encouraged by our ability, plants, animals, humans, to adapt?
Yes, absolutely. Humans are one of the most adaptable species in Earth's history. There's a lot we can do even in very bad situations. So I think that there's still a lot of potential in all Homo sapiens. We just have to make good on it.
So are we at risk? Are we the next dinosaurs? Are we at risk of going extinct anytime in the near future, or in our, not in our lifetimes, but in the foreseeable future, Dr. Cameron?
Oh yeah, for sure. But that's what we have to stop.
And we do have to stop right now because we're out of time. Dr. Christian Cameron, research curator at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Science, Dr. Aviva Rossi with the University of San Francisco, and Manly Fuller with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation. Thank you all.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.